To get a better perspective on the local election results, WBGO's Janice Kirkell spoke with John Weingart, Associate Director of the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University.
John, thanks for being with us. Why don't we start by talking about the marijuana question that was on the ballot this year in New Jersey? What are your thoughts on how that played out?
Governor Murphy, as a candidate, was very explicit that he wanted to legalize marijuana. Both for its the criminal justice questions in terms of the ways in which people were punished for violating those laws and how discriminatory that was and sort of arbitrary, and he was very clear that that's what he wanted to do, and he got elected by a large margin, so that may have been a factor. But this referendum takes away, I think, the last obstacle that he was facing, his administration was facing, and I gather it will take them maybe a year or two to put the regulations in place that would make the change effective, that marijuana would become legal. But it's a significant change in public opinion across the country over the last 10 years or so, and it will put New Jersey among the states where it is legal, where there may be some tax benefits, revenue coming into the state, others coming into the direct treasury from taxes on marijuana. You know, it's a significant policy change and a decisive win.
The way legalization of marijuana ended up playing out in New Jersey by putting the question to the people, this seems to be part of a trend. This has happened in a number of other states where marijuana has been legalized. Do you think a lot of this has to do with the, you know, legislators seeking political cover in case, Magnum might not be so popular with some voters, and it's kind of easier not to have it on your record as that you're in favor of legalization?
Yeah, I think that's some of it, maybe a lot of it. But, I mean, there were different points of view in the legislature, including within the Democratic Party. And there were some legislators who feel it's a mistake to legalize marijuana, and that either it should be decriminalized or left sort of as it is, illegal. And so, and then there were other legislators who either were indifferent to the idea or supported legalization, but as you say, felt that might be unpopular in their district, and that the affirmation by voters in a referendum of support for legalization would make it easier for them to support implementation of that policy change. New Jersey, unlike some other states, does not have initiative in referendum where we're often faced with policy issues as voters, whether to vote them up or down. And I think that's generally a good thing that we don't have that. But in part, it's a good thing because it's hard to word those questions in a way that's sufficiently precise that the wording doesn't come back to haunt people if it does pass. But in this case, the issue is sufficiently clear that I think it was pretty easy to word it in a way that the voters knew what they were voting on and could be clear of what position they wanted to take.
Turning to the congressional races in New Jersey, it seems that the state's congressional delegation has become significantly more Democratic in recent years, the bluing of New Jersey, we might call it. What are some of your thoughts on this?
Well, I think the Northeast of the country in general has become more Democratic, and some of the trends we see in the presidential race of more suburban people are moving to being Democrats, and New Jersey has a lot of suburbs, and more highly educated people, more people with college degrees are moving toward the Democratic Party, and New Jersey has a lot of people that fall in that category as well.
What about the issue going forward of the voting process, given that this was such an atypical year because of the pandemic, millions of people voting by mail-in ballots? What kind of changes do you see in the years ahead for how we vote?
Well, I think there will be a lot of attention to the voting process and to how it works and ways to improve it. Whether there will be change is a harder question because it's easier to say the current system's got problems than it is to say how do we fix them. And you know, after the 2000 race, when Al Gore against George Bush for president, with the results so close, there was a national effort to have to make election administration more reliable and maybe rational. And some of those changes went into effect and stayed, but much of it just was discussion that didn't go anywhere. And I think that's the challenge, will be the challenge this time in New Jersey. It seems likely that once the impact of COVID recedes more, that life will not return to being exactly the way it was in all sorts of areas, and that absentee ballot voting or voting by mail that became so much more, was used so much more as a way to express your opinion this year in New Jersey as well as nationally, that will stay to a large extent, that the legislature or the administration will put into place procedures that make it, they clarify how one registers to vote and makes it as easy as possible to register and to vote. And that may end up being a positive legacy of the pandemic, that that turnout, you know, and the turnout was higher this year because of passions about the candidates and particularly passions about President Trump. But it also was probably higher because it was easier to vote. I mean, you could vote from home. And so I think there will be more focus on the election system.
I believe everybody in New Jersey was automatically mailed a mail-in ballot. Would you see something like that continuing?
Yeah, I mean, I would hope what will happen is there'll be some kind of public hearings to evaluate how that worked and what were the problems with that. The people who were mailed ballots were the people who were already registered to vote. I think that a challenge going forward will be to make the process of registering for first-time voters as easy as possible.
Thank you, John. Any thoughts you want to leave us with? It has been quite a year.
I just met with a class I teach of freshmen at Rutgers, and I think everybody is emotionally, I shouldn't say everybody, but most everybody is emotionally drained by this year's election. I don't know if people can find ways to address the very clear partisan divide that exists to a lesser extent in New Jersey than nationally, but does exist, to find pathways for people with different political views to talk to each other and to talk to each other about substance and to be friends, whether or not they talk about politics. I think all those are questions that will concern and bedevil people in New Jersey, as in the rest of the country, and hopefully we'll find some positive ways to make things better.
John Weingart of the Eagleton Institute at Rutgers, thanks very much for being with us on the Journal.
WBGO's Janice Kirkell. Thanks, Janice. Joining us on the WBGO Journal is John R. Green, the Emmy Award-winning ABC TV producer and writer, and now the author of two companion books about children and dealing with dreams, and for the most part, bad dreams, and how you can turn them around and make them into whimsical adventures. A 25-year veteran of ABC News. John, great to have you on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
I'm sure the first question that people have been asking you after this wonderful career you've had at ABC TV News, and now you're venturing into children's books. When did that pop into your head?
Well, I'm not giving up my day job. I still love what I do for ABC News. I do a lot of primetime specials over there in the news and documentary space. And some entertainment specials as well for ABC. So I'm definitely not giving that up. But a miracle, I should say, two miracles happened in my life 8 years ago when my children were born. I was a 45-year-old first-time dad. I had just been diagnosed with cancer. There was no guarantee of what my future would be or if I would be alive to see my kids grow up. But when that happened, I said, this is the time for you to double down and pursue passions outside of work, pay it forward. Everything that I had put on the back burner, I put on the front burner. First and foremost was taking care of my kids and making sure that they had a nice environment to be in and would prosper as they grew older. And about 3 years into being a dad, when my kids started suffering from sleep issues, for my son, AJ, the problem was that he was scared of nightmares. My daughter, Francesca, had a different problem. She just didn't want to be alone at night. She wanted to sleep in our bedroom. And so I created some rituals to help them get to bed. The ritual I created for AJ was by rubbing his head, I could actually see the bad dreams hiding inside of his head. And with my magic powers, I could pull those dreams out, throw them up into the sky. And then he would say, but Dad, what am I going to dream now? There's nothing left in there. And I said, wait a second, AJ. I can also, through my magic, see the good dreams that are flying around invisibly in the sky, and I can grab them, and there's one, and there's one, and then I can put them in your head. And so that became our ritual at night, and it worked for him, and he started to sleep, and he lost his fear of nightmares. For my daughter, wanting not to be alone at night, I created another bit of magic for her, which was that I had magic powers to jump into her dreams with her. So every night before she goes to bed, and we still do this today when she's 8 years old, we sit and we creatively brainstorm about where we want to go, some exotic place on earth, or what kind of dreams we want to jump into together. The very first one that she wanted was to slide down a rainbow with me into a pool of teddy bears. And I don't know if you had a chance to see the cover of one of the books, but that was the inspiration behind Dream Jumper and the cover of that book.
These books are wonderfully illustrated. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Susan Shorter's your illustrator when it comes to Dream Grabber and Dream Jumper. So these are basically come right from you, right from your head and your experiences with your children. Obviously, they have to be pretty excited about this too now, because it's their stories that are being told.
They are super excited, especially when the illustrations came back and they saw how much the characters in the books look like them. And that's another interesting story that I'll share with you. I had never done an illustrated book before, and I was so blessed to be partnered with Susan Shorter, a wonderfully talented illustrator. But I made a point of not sharing any pictures of my kids with her. I wanted to see what would happen solely based on descriptions that I gave her over the phone of my children. And I'll never forget when she sent me the first mock-ups of the illustrations, it was lifelike to me. It looked just like my daughter and just like my son. So I'm really excited about that. And yeah, the kids are thrilled. They keep asking me, are we famous now? Are we famous? And I say, you've always been famous since the moment you were born.
That's wonderful. You know, have you had difficulties with dreams throughout your life?
I have. Thank you for asking me. Nobody's asked me that yet. I have. I actually have suffered on and off through my life with nightmares and even night terrors where I wake up screaming. And it doesn't happen as often as it used to when I was in my 20s and 30s. But I sought help from a doctor, and I think, you know, what they said is that you're just one of these people that, harbors a lot of your anxiety and a lot of your thought processes in your head as you're going to sleep, and you don't have great sleep habits. You don't do anything to put yourself in the right mode for a peaceful night of sleep. And they're right. I'm on my work emails up until the moment I turn the light out. Still to this day, I now, of course, have an iPhone in my hand. I don't do what the doctors recommend, and so I only have myself to blame. And it, like I said, I don't. I get a pretty good night of sleep. I would say 6 out of 7 nights a week, but there's always at least one night a week where I'm wakened by a nightmare.
The books will be available pre-sale through Amazon, and they will be released at Barnes & Noble and Amazon on November 10th, and they're published by Archway. You know, as soon as I saw this, and as soon as you started to talk about your experiences with your kids, I started to think back when my daughter was young. I would have a long ride to take her home to her mom's place. And so I came up with this character who was half man and half animal. And every holiday or every event, we would have an adventure. And that's how I'd get through the long rides on the Garden State Parkway. And sometimes she would want to hear it. And I'd say, wait to the tolls, because I didn't know if I had enough information for to change a story around. But kids do grab on to these stories. They're like anybody else. Storytelling is what it's all about. It's what you do at ABC. So I understand the storytelling aspect, but this had to be a whole new adventure for you writing, you know, when you're doing wonderful documentaries and series and primetime specials. This is a whole different kind of mindset for you, isn't it?
It definitely is. You're writing for a specific audience, kids between the age of 4 and 7, and most of them will be read the book by their parents. So with that in mind, I wrote the books in verse. First of all, I thought my kids love rhyme and most of the kids that I know love rhyme. So I definitely don't write my documentaries in verse or news packages in verse. I don't know if I could do that, but that was a lot of fun. But I think the challenge in writing children's books, from my experience, as opposed to writing what I do in news and documentary, is making, I don't want to say making the language flowery, that's not the word that I'm looking for, but making it phantasmical, or that's not the right word. What's the word I'm looking for? Help me out here. It's something that will evoke images for the kids, even though they're looking at the illustrations. I want the words to also feel illustrated, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Vivid pictures coming into their minds because of, you know, the words that you've created. You've been creating for a long time. You're the executive vice president of Rockin' Robin Productions in New York City. Robin Roberts, a good friend of yours. You've been working with her for years. I would imagine she's quite excited about this venture for you.
She's been so supportive. She was very kind in endorsing both books, and you'll see her endorsements on the back of the books. But she has always been a colleague and friend that's nurtured my passions. About 6 years ago, we started a production company together, and she's just a true, beautiful human being. Everything you see when you see her on TV, on Good Morning America, or on other shows is exactly who she is. And very, very fortunate to have the partnership that I have with her, the support that I get from her. And then we both also work at ABC News. And I've been fortunate to be there for, 26 years now. And my bosses there are also very encouraging of people indulging, not just in family time, but in any pursuit outside of work that doesn't conflict with work. And since we don't do children's books through ABC News, there wasn't a conflict there.
Not at all. When you're thinking about your career, you know, 25 years plus as a veteran of ABC News, we're in, you know, amazing times right now. But as you look at your career, is there some point that you would say this was, you know, the project I'm most proud of, or at least the time period that was most fun to be at ABC News?
I would definitely say that there were a lot of fun times, but I always go back to what I felt was the most pivotal time, and that was September 11th, 2001. That morning, which was a Tuesday morning, as you probably remember, I was in the control room running the live show for Good Morning America, and we were live on the air. And so when the first plane struck, the first tower, between 8:30 and 9, I had to tell our anchors, it was Diane Sawyer and Charlie Gibson at the time, that we were going to go on what we call a special network-wide bulletin, a special event, breaking news event. But everything was so sketchy at that point. The first reports, the radio scanners were all just suggesting, as you probably remember, that a small prop plane had flown off course. But one of our correspondents, a guy named Don Daler, who lived downtown, near the towers called, and he grew up close to an Air Force base, and he got on the phone and he said, John, listen, that was no prop plane. It went over my head and it was a jet, and I would probably guess a passenger jet. And then I had chills down my spine. And that experience, which of course led to weeks and weeks of coverage, round the clock coverage on September 11th, the aftermath, the recovery of the victims, and of course, the hunt for Osama bin Laden and our fight against terrorism, I just think that that changed everybody's life. It's similar in a way to how the pandemic has changed everybody's life, but the pandemic story is not over yet. We're kind of in the middle of it right now. So looking back at those 25 plus years, I definitely go back to September 11th.
You've already had an amazing career. John R. Green has been our guest here on the WBGO Journal, the Emmy Award-winning ABC TV producer and writer, now the author of two new children's books, Dream Grabber and Dream Jumper, about his children that other kids now can enjoy and hopefully get a better night's sleep because of John R. Green. Thanks so much for joining us on the WBGO Journal.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.